children. What are we gonna do to show we care? How are we gonna be there for our children when they feel that life has just not been that fair?
Good evening and welcome back to Masks Weekly Radio Show on Family Matters. Mask mothers and fathers align saving kids, kids of all ages and all stages for all mental health struggles, including addiction. If you know somebody that needs a therapist, an inpatient or outpatient program, please give us a call at 718-758-0400. I'll repeat the number. You may want to jot it down. The self, a loved one, a neighbor, or someone you usually sit next to in shul. Remember, all calls are kept strictly confidential. Again, our number, 718-758-0400. If you want to get a free naloxone kit for prevention of opioid overdose, please give us a call and we can set up a Zoom or in-person training for the naloxone. Anyone should have a naloxone kit. Today, you never know, a neighbor, a family member, or someone in your shul, so, or school, so maybe struggling with addiction, and it's good to have one around. So give us a call, 718-758-0400. Tonight, I really am very honored that Dr. David Rosmarin is on with us. He is a very, very sought after doctor, great clinician, director, founder of the Center for Anxiety. And it truly is an honor because he is so busy. So I'd like to welcome you on, doctor. Thank you for coming on tonight.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Rosmarin, you're an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. You're a program director at McLean Hospital. You're the founder of the Center of Anxiety, which has, I know you've seen, minimum 1,000 patients in different states a year. You're an international expert on spirituality and mental health, and even authored a book on that topic. And you've been featured in so many different journals and papers and different Scientific American, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and more. I would like you first, if you can tell my listeners, what made you open the Center for Anxiety, please?
Sure. Thanks. You've made me anxious, by the way, with that intro. Center for Anxiety started in 2011. I had just finished my postdoctoral fellowship, and an interesting opportunity came in Boston. That was where I did my training. And an interesting opportunity came to open up a clinic in Manhattan in the Flatiron District. I took the plunge. I got on a train and was down there 2 days a week, and I would come back and do my academic work the rest of the time. And over the coming years, it grew. Now Center for Anxiety has 7 different offices, ranging from Massachusetts down to New Jersey. And we are, like you said, seeing well over 1,000 patients on an annual basis, with nearly 50 clinicians on staff, and going strong, and really feeling very blessed that we're able to service such a large number of people on an annual basis.
And I know that we at Mass refer many clients to your practices, and they always say how professional it is and how much help they do receive there. Anxiety disorders, they are treatable, yet they say that maybe 35-40%, you know, only get treatment. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that's changed in recent years. We see more people coming in with lower levels of anxiety, which is good. Ideally, we'd like to be preventing. I'd like to see people who have no anxiety, which is really before they do have significant anxiety. Because let's face it, everybody at some point hits some sort of a speed bump, roadblock, whatever it is. And stress and anxiety are usually the first symptoms to manifest. If we don't take care of them, well, they can change into things like depression or things like addictions or other issues. But anxiety is usually the first step, first railroad crossing, major railroad crossing on the mental health train. And we like to see people as early as possible because prevention is really where it's at. The best case for us, people come in 4, 5, 6 sessions and they're really settled. And our data suggests that. 40% of our patients, 50% or so, will take that trajectory. Unfortunately for the others, they've waited too long and need more sessions, sometimes 20, 30, maybe even longer, many more sessions in order to deal with whatever's there. And sometimes there's comorbidities and other issues as well. So, you know, to your point, you know, getting in early and trying to deal with these issues, getting the tools that we need, to me, that's what it's all about today.
Absolutely. And like you said, I mean, everyone between COVID and the war going on and regular life and maybe in their genes, I mean, there are, you know, many today. When I started Mass 27 years ago, and remember I spoken and had over 122,000 families already, I know that we started with addiction. But today, our main callers are about anxiety, OCD, and depression. So I'd like you, if you can, to please just bring to, you know, the attention of my listeners the different types of anxiety, briefly.
Sure. Most common is generalized anxiety, where people are worried. Worried about the future, worried about finances, worried about health, worried about Bubby and Zadie, whatever it is that we're worried about, something. But it's a little bit excessive. It's the kind of thing that we can't control. That's when we really need to start coming in and getting some help, if we find our worries are getting the better of us, which is pretty common these days. I don't know too many people who aren't having significant worry or anxiety in some way. So that would be your number one way. Often people have more specific fears. It could be as specific as driving. People who are really fine in every area of their life, but when it comes to driving, they freak out. They really can't handle that. Or dogs or snakes, heights, you know, elevators, these kinds of things. We call them specific phobias. And that's something which is also very common. You mentioned OCD before. It's not technically an anxiety disorder, but most of OCD has strong components of anxiety. So we treat a lot of folks with OCD. That is another relatively common one. Social anxiety, people who are concerned in social situations. Basically, it's when your heart's racing, apprehension in primarily social situations, but often it translates to others as well. These are all very common. This is the kind of stuff that we do day in, day out.
So, doctor, let's get to the conversation of that you wrote a book now called Thriving with Anxiety. And I'd like to know, what message do you hope your readers take away from it? And how has your work at Center for Anxiety, like, informed your approach to writing the book Thriving with Anxiety?
Sure. Yes. This recent book, Thriving with Anxiety, it's out with HarperCollins as the publisher. And I'll tell you the story behind it. During the pandemic, I was really nervous because we had tons of patients. At that time, I think we had 500 or 600 patients who were active. And here we were going into the pandemic. We had to moved to telehealth entirely in 2 weeks, all of my staff, all of our patients. You know, there are these early reports of anxiety and suicidality and self-injury going through the roof. And here I am with this huge liability risk of hundreds of people who are being treated by this program and my staff as well. And, you know, what was going to be? I was really nervous, quite anxious myself, actually. And what was amazing to me, Ruchama, was what happened, or more like what didn't happen. Our patients fared very well. And I noticed this, that some of our patients were actually doing better during the early pandemic than ever before. And many of them were reporting that their friends and family were anxious for the first time, but they actually were doing quite well because they had the skills and the tools. They had learned that in psychotherapy. So a couple years later, last year, really, I teamed up with my long-term colleague, Dr. Stephen Piratinsky, who lives in the Lakewood area, I should say. And we actually ran an analysis on 764 of our patients who started either before the pandemic, during the pandemic, or after the pandemic. And what we found, amazingly, was that the statistics matched on to that experience that I had. The patients who had come to us before treatment did not, before the pandemic, rather, before March 2020, did not have an uptick in anxiety at any point during the pandemic. That group as a whole actually fared extremely well, while the rest of the world was plagued with anxiety. And I realized something that I had sort of bumped into a couple times during my career, but never in such a clear way, is that anxiety can be a catalyst to thriving in our lives. It can actually be a blessing when we use it as a stepping stone to get the skills that we need to move forward in our lives. All we need is to get the skills. And once we have those in place, we actually can become inoculated against once a century level stress. And the book is about which skills people can use to turn their anxiety into a blessing in order to move them forward in their lives.
The book is wonderful, I must say. And I wonder if you want to outline some of the key principles or techniques that you discuss in Thriving with Anxiety.
Sure.
For actually confronting the anxiety. How do you suggest you respond to anxiety?
Sure. One of the first things that we tend to do in our society when we feel anxious is to try to squelch those feelings, to try to reduce them, get rid of them. We instantly run to a pharmacologist often and start medicating it away with benzodiazepines like Xanax and Valium and such. And nothing against pharmacology per se, but at the same time, when it's our first response to get rid of these uncomfortable feelings, I think what we're doing is buying into a model that states that these feelings aren't normal, that they are dangerous, that they are medically problematic. And there isn't evidence to suggest that. People feel anxious when they're under stress, when they're going through turmoil, when the world is upside down. And also, just as a matter of course, all human beings at some point are going to feel anxious. And that being the case, we really have to ask ourselves, is this a medical disease? Or is this a part of life that we need to learn to deal with, that we need to actually metabolize and integrate into who we are as people, and to get the skills we need to manage? If you take the latter approach, then it's not a disease model. What we're actually saying is that it is human to feel anxious. And furthermore, when we lean into those feelings, allow ourselves to feel anxious, it doesn't feel good, but it does strengthen us. It does make us more emotionally resilient. Much like going to the gym also isn't comfortable. You're sweating, you're uncomfortable, you're pumping iron, you're feeling pain in your arms, but that specifically is what gives us more physical strength. Well, emotional strength is very similar. And when we lean into our anxiety and we are brave and allow ourselves to experience it, some pretty amazing things happen.
So would you like to share maybe in what ways does Thriving with Anxiety offer like a unique perspective on living with anxiety?
A unique perspective. I think the first tack that we take when we are confronted with anxiety again is that we try to get rid of it. And what I'm saying is that that's not adaptive. That's actually not helpful. In fact, the more you try to get rid of your anxiety, usually the worse it gets. the more you try to squelch it and avoid it and run away from it and medicate it away, typically that increases our anxiety because you've really created a cascade that you become afraid of the actual anxious feelings, as opposed to standing up to them and saying, bring it on. This is going to be uncomfortable, but I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to allow myself to feel it. One of the techniques we do in cognitive behavior therapy is called exposure therapy. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
All right. Well, for your listeners who haven't, it involves exposure, or actually confronting that which you are afraid of. So if you're afraid of, like I mentioned before, heights or driving or flying or animals, then, well, in therapy, we're going to confront those together, you know, as a clinician and as a patient. And then eventually the patient starts doing them on their own. And it is very uncomfortable. People start to sweat. They start to feel their heart palpitate. They feel, you know, stomach distress. All the symptoms of anxiety start. But once they realize that it's just a fleeting emotion and the anxiety will never kill them, people actually become very resilient and very strong to be able to handle it. Now, I don't recommend doing this necessarily on your own. Often we need a coach to help us or a therapist. But in theory, it could be done on your own. And either way, the general approach is counterintuitive, that the more you stand up to this feeling, the more it emboldens us and the more it strengthens us to be able to face other stressors in our life.
And what do you find most effective in managing your own anxiety?
I will tell you, it is not easy to face fears and to face up to certain stressors and difficulties. Honestly, the more Center for Anxiety grows, the more difficulties and stressors there are day to day. It's a, you know, large organization, and I've sort of pivoted into a leadership role that I never thought that I would be in, frankly. It's really important to balance. I do long distance running, so that's definitely something which is very important to me and keeps me sane and healthy and gives me a chance to decompress. So I try to balance my stress and my resources. But also facing anxiety is something that I try to do myself. Try to do something that makes me uncomfortable at least once a week, if not more than that.
Okay. Dr. Rosemarie, let's go to panic attacks. Many people call the helpline that they ended up in the hospital. They had a panic attack. They thought they were having a heart attack. Can you describe to my listeners why it looks like you're having a heart attack, but in reality, maybe it just symptoms of a panic attack?
Sure. Yeah, like to your point, a lot of people go with panic attacks to the hospital thinking they're having a heart attack. Ironically, a lot of people have heart attacks and they don't even know until they end up at a cardiologist's office, either for routine or for whatever reasons. And then, hey, you know that there's quite a bit of plaque buildup in there. So the interesting thing about panic is it's very strong. It's a very strong emotional response. You sort of can't ignore it when it happens. It's lots of physical symptoms of anxiety which are cascading upon each other. The main thing that's driving those feelings is a fear of the symptoms themselves. When we are afraid of constricted breathing, of what it means, you know, potentially, like you said, people are afraid of having a heart attack, people are afraid that they're dying, that's going to increase your adrenaline. Well, that constricts the blood vessels even more, which increases your breathing, increases your heart rate. The symptoms cascade upon each other. The more you feel the symptoms, the more worried you get, and then the more you start to feel the symptoms. So, if people are concerned about having a heart attack, not a bad idea to get checked out, but not more than once. If you've been given clearance from a doctor, from a medical doctor about heart condition, then we're dealing with panic, and that's definitely a time to come into the office.
And like you said, we encourage people to go in earlier for prevention, that it shouldn't turn into something as extreme as a panic attack.
That's a good point. Panic is out of the blue, but more often than not, it does occur in the context of stress. People are very stressed out or having a relationship difficulty or something that they've been ignoring, and then all of a sudden your body won't let you ignore it anymore. So That is a good point.
Would you like to just elaborate on any common misconceptions about anxiety in your book and how to address them, please?
The biggest misconception we have about anxiety is that it's dangerous. I have never lost a patient to high anxiety alone. None of my colleagues at anxiety centers around the world have ever had a patient die in their offices from high anxiety. Anxiety will not kill you. Something else will kill you one day, hopefully, after 120 years. But anxiety is not going to be the cause of that death. And people often, it might feel like death, but feeling like death and being an actual threat are not the same. And when it comes to anxiety, our society has made us very, I shouldn't even say made, we have bought into a societal belief, norm, that you should never feel anxious and you should never feel upset. And that's just not true. Human beings get distressed. This is part of who we are. And when we confront that and embrace it, it's a game changer. It's just a game changer for how we deal with our emotions in general.
So do you want to explain what actually happens in the mind and the body when they experience the anxiety and what the person, what you suggest they should respond
sure.
when they're feeling it?
The primary thing today, especially for people who live in the American world, is something is not right here. We start to feel those symptoms. We feel a little bit constricted breath. We feel our heart beating a little fast. We start to feel a little flushed and hot. And then we think, oh my God, something isn't okay. As opposed to, oh wow, it's a Tuesday afternoon and I'm having anxiety because there's this much stress in the world and this is just who I am and this is what's happening to me. If we take that latter approach, the anxiety settles down. Once we accept it, once we understand this is part of being human, and we don't judge ourselves getting upset about it, then the anxiety settles. But if we take that former approach, something is wrong with me, we try to get rid of the anxiety, we try to hide it, we medicate it away, we run to drinking, we hide in the closet, so to speak, we run, you know, we don't tell anybody about how we're feeling, we avoid situations that might make us anxious, and all of those approaches make anxiety substantially worse. When we accept that this is part of humanity and that we will feel anxious and that's okay, and really get to a place of acceptance around that, like I said, it's a total game changer.
So if mom or dad suffer with anxiety, you know, they say kids see how parents act. And they may then start to mimic their reactions to different things the way the parents or adults, you know, that are suffering with anxiety. So what do you want to say to parents that have young children sure. that may be suffering with anxiety?
I will tell the parents who have anxious children the following. I have never met an anxious child who did not have at least one anxious parent. Never. All anxious children that I've seen have at least one anxious parent.
They That's don't what we always say on the helpline when
they don't
people call.
So often the anxious parent will bring in their anxious child when really they're not dealing with their own anxiety. So we want to see the parents, not just the kids.
Right. So let's talk about that. The sure. role that you believe in the support systems, family, friends, therapy, play, and navigating anxiety. Let's talk about each one, family, friends, the system.
Sure. Well, when it comes to kids, you know, we will not, as a matter of policy, see kids on their own below age 6, 7. And even then, ages, you know, 7 to 10, 7 to 15 even, we will involve parents as much as we can. Because there's a family system going on here. Like you said, you know, when parents are overreactive, how did therapy go? Is everything okay? You know, that overreaction, overbearance, you know, something is wrong unless you are getting rid of your anxiety. That message, whether we send it explicitly or implicitly to our kids, makes them more unnerved. And it has to be settled that, like, they're okay. We're all people are going to feel distress at some points. If your goal is to get rid of all your distress, you're going to lose. You lose that battle. And parents, you know, anxious parents, I'll even say anxious Jewish parents especially, need to get that message. If your goal is to reduce all of the distress, all of the difficulties that your kids are going to have, you're going to lose. You're going to lose that battle. In fact, you're going to make more problems for yourself and for your kids.
So you want to share how when one reads a book that they actually can reframe the relationship with anxiety?
Well, I prefer to hear from listeners and readers themselves in terms of what they get from the book. And I'll tell you that folks who do read the book are welcome to reach out to me. Through my website, I read every message that comes through, and you know, I'm very happy to engage with people about it. I think we broke the book up into 9 tools. The subtitle of the book is 9 Tools to Make Your Anxiety Work for You. And the first thing I say in there is this book will not make you less anxious. The goal is not to become less anxious. It's to learn to utilize your anxiety in a constructive, positive way. When we take this approach of this is part of who I am now, can I use it to actually fuel my engine as opposed to trying to get rid of it? It changes everything.
Well, doctor, we're running out of time. In a minute or less, let us hear about your other book that you wrote.
Well, what I will tell people with less than a minute is how to contact me, which is through my website, dhrosmarin, rosmarin.com, dhrosmarin.com. Please reach out. Very, very happy to engage with listeners and anybody who's looking for more information about anxiety. There is some information about other books I've written also, although I'm definitely, this last one has been well received by the media and by the general public. I think we sold over 10,000 copies so far. So I'm definitely still on this tear, and hopefully got more gas in my tank. And I'm just really grateful for this conversation with you.
Well, it's wonderful having you on. And I hope to have you on again soon so that we can continue talking about depression, anxiety, and what is available out there. Let us just name the different areas that you have an office in, please.
You want to know where you can find me? Sure. Centerforanxiety.org. We have 7 offices, the 2 in Massachusetts, in Boston, and in Cambridge. 4 in the New York area, which are in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Great Neck, and Rockland County, and a 7th office in Princeton, New Jersey.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful having you on, and I hope to have you on again soon.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I want to wish everyone a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos, and always remember, hang in, hold on, hug tight. Tonight's show is in honor of all the Chayalim. Bring the hostages home now. Please consider to go online to maskparents.org and donate so that we can continue with all the mask programs. Thank you. Have a good night.
This is Idanis Rodriguez, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Transportation. Mayor Eric Adams and I want to remind you that things happen fast on the street. When you're driving, your speed can feel slow, but if you hit someone, it's terrifyingly fast. Drivers, watch out for pedestrians and cyclists and slow your turns to less than 5 miles per hour. Remember, speeding ruins lives. Slow down.
Tsvasman's have been in the jewelry wholesale business for 40 years and opened their first store location in Crown Heights 12 years ago. They've gained a following well beyond Crown Heights and now opened their second location in the heart of Surfside, Florida on Harding Avenue. They specialize in bridal, special occasion, custom, and everyday fine jewelry. Visit either of their 2 locations on Instagram or via their website, tjewelers.com. That's tjewelers.com.